Some folks can look forward to a bigger paycheck in the new year and a look backward at trade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, December 25th. Good to have you with us, and Merry Christmas to all those celebrating. With the holiday winding down, it's time to look ahead to the new year, when more than a million American workers will become eligible for overtime pay. On January 1st, the Labor Department's new salary threshold for overtime kicks in. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the rules have been a long time coming.
Many workers are entitled to overtime pay when they work more than 40 hours a week. But salaried workers with managerial or professional responsibilities can be required to work extra hours without extra pay, says Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute.
So frontline supervisors of retail workers, fast food workers, they can still spend a lot of their time just working side by side with the workers that they manage and can be asked to work 10, 20, 30 hours of overtime a week for no additional pay.
Under the new salary threshold, employers will have to pay overtime to any manager making less than $35,568 a year. The Obama administration would have raised that to about $47,500.
Workers will earn $1.4 billion less per year under the Trump rule just because there's fewer workers that are going to get overtime protections.
The Trump administration plan will be easier to comply with, says employment lawyer Ryan Glasgow at Hunton Andrews Kurth.
I mean, I think for the most part, most employers view this as a reasonable salary level.
Employers have a few choices now. They can raise manager salaries above the new threshold or track those managers' hours and pay overtime, which can be tricky for morale, says HR attorney Shannon Farmer at Ballard Spahr.
Particularly those people who do have, you know, more administrative or professional jobs, and now they're being treated equivalent to an hourly worker.
Those employees now paid by the hour will have to track all their work time, even when they do email at night or on weekends, as the job never really ends in a digital age. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Labor issues were one of the big sticking points in the recently approved NAFTA replacement, the USMCA. And business owners in Texas are paying particularly close attention to that agreement. In 2018, Canada and Mexico bought almost half of Texas exports. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what Texas business owners are looking for in this new deal.
Goods and services exported to Mexico and Canada from Texas last year were valued at more than $137 billion. Most of that, almost $110 billion, went from Texas to Mexico.
The border states are so integrated with the Mexican economy, particularly Texas, which has almost four times as much exports to Mexico as any state.
That's economist Ray Perryman in Waco, Texas. He says what Texas exports to Mexico runs the gamut, from oil and gas to electronics and car engines. President Trump has been highly critical of NAFTA, calling it, quote, a disaster for the United States. But Perryman says throwing out the trade deal with no replacement wasn't a viable option for Texas businesses.
Just about everyone I've talked to in Texas almost unanimously is just that we needed to get an agreement done.
And Federico Schaffler, who studies cross-border commerce at Texas A&M International University in Laredo, says the need for a deal goes beyond duty-free trade.
The way that modern supply chains are interwoven, it is practically impossible to break them down.
He says in the auto industry, for example, cars and parts go back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico numerous times, so any barriers throw a wrench into the process.
Even though it is a very easy to say, it is not something that could be really done in our globalized economy.
The deal maintains many things that were in NAFTA, but it also raises labor standards and includes updates on digital commerce and environmental practices. Tony Bennett is president of the Texas Association of Manufacturers. He says his group didn't get everything it wanted from the negotiations, but
we're happy with what we've gotten so far. We will work on some of the elements that are still missing.
USMCA was passed in the U.S. House last week and is expected to head to the Senate early next year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The markets were closed for the holiday, so we'll give Wall Street a break today. Coming up, a special holiday edition of The Numbers. Speaking of trade deals, if you listen to this program regularly, you know we cover this issue a lot. But it has been quite the topic in these past 18 months, including what Andy just talked about. Now, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore joins me for a bit of a longer view, looking back at the 2010s in trade and what that action means for the economy going into the 2020s. Hey, Sabri.
Hi, Kimberly.
So what was the highlight for you when you think about 2019 in terms of what goes down in history for international trade?
2019 will be the year that the U.S. really began to burn down the international rules-based system in international trade. So whatever consequences history will reveal, good or bad, this is the year it really got set in motion.
The year of burn it all down. Okay, so you're referring to the trade conflict with China, the tariffs, and I guess everybody else,
yes,
too.
Yeah, I'm referring to all of it. So let's just start with the tariffs. The U.S. imposed tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods from China, up to a total of $250 billion. There were lots of threats and escalations and retaliation all along the way. That was the big fight. And the key here is that these were all conducted through not some international trading system. They weren't done through the WTO. They were just done unilaterally by the U.S. And we also have the fight with the WTO itself. So the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. helped build, the U.S. has basically shut down that group's top court, which settles trade disputes, and it's holding up the WTO's budget. So here is one view of all of this, from a trade lawyer, Nicole Bivens-Collinson, with Sandler, Travis, and Rosenberg.
If you're trying to get somebody to change their mind or to take their medicine, if you put it in a spoonful of sugar, but then you grab them around the throat, choking them, trying to get them to open their mouth, that's not an effective way of, I think, addressing the trade policy.
So that's one view of what has happened this year. The Trump administration would say, you know, we had to do this. The WTO is not equipped to take on Chinese subsidies, and we don't want to wait around for them to figure it out while China eats our lunch. The rest of the world is saying, fine, but you didn't have to burn it all down. You know, if you're going to go outside of the rules, so will we. And that is what we are actually starting to see.
So what are you looking for in 2020? What is next year going to look like, as you say, if international trade institutions are just being kind of thrown under the bus?
Okay, so first off, China. We have this preliminary deal. It doesn't fix everything. But the question is the fight over? Is it going to blow up again? That's happened before. Remember back in May, we had a deal and then we didn't. So are we even out of the woods on that one? We don't know, really. Second, who is next in the crosshairs for the U.S.? The answer is it looks like it's going to be Europe. The Trump administration is laying the groundwork for tariffs on France over a disagreement on digital taxes, which, by the way, there was a way to resolve that through negotiation, but it looks like the Trump administration is not waiting around for that. There is still this lingering threat of tariffs on automobiles. But here's the thing. Europe has its own beef with the U.S. Here's Scott Linscombe. He's with the Cato Institute.
The U.S. and the EU appear to be heading towards a more pointed confrontation, with the EU also looking at things like carbon tariffs. Some EU officials have expressly said we'll be targeting the United States.
So Scott mentioned a carbon tariff there. That is basically a tariff against countries that are not in the Paris Climate Agreement or who aren't taking climate change seriously. That's something also that's not covered by the WTO. And, you know, Europe is basically saying, OK, you want to take this fight outside? We can do that. We have our own issues. And so the U.S. will be getting more than just the fights it wants to pick. By the way, there's a cost to these fights. Consumers pay more. Businesses hold off on investment. U.S. exporters are disadvantaged. So for whatever benefits we may accrue, there are costs, and we will see how that all nets out in 2020.
So more trade drama to come. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore, thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
The This week, we're looking back at the past decade and forward to the next one with some of our Marketplace reporters. And remember how I was just talking to Sabri about the trade war with China? Well, what's happened in China's economy over the last decade is a story all its own. And for that, I'll turn to our China correspondent, Jennifer Pak. She joins me from Shanghai for a look back and ahead. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Kimberly.
So how has the Chinese economy changed over the past decade?
Oh, a lot, a lot. One big thing that I realized was I was in Beijing in 2006 to 2009. By the time I left, there were some cell phones. But when I returned in 2015, I suddenly couldn't live without a smartphone. If you go to a restaurant, if you're trying to book a taxi or even pay for a taxi or buy a vegetable from the lady off the street, you need mobile payment in Shanghai. You have worker attitudes changing drastically. They don't call it work-life balance, but there's certainly a resistance against the 12-hour workday, 6 days a week. The other thing is also national savings rate. It's still high, but certainly amongst young people, they are more willing to spend on credit. So mobile payment companies are offering lines of credit to them. And because of e-commerce platforms being right on your cell phone, they could just click a button and then they can get potato chips delivered in half an hour, or they can get the latest lipstick color. This is a new thing, getting things now and spending almost like how Americans do. So that's a massive change in China's economy.
And this kind of speaks to the growing middle class in China that's really emerged and become a powerful force in the last decade.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of them are willing to spend. So as the economy is slowing down, especially with exports, China used to be the factory floor for the world. Actually, more and more businesses are selling to Chinese consumers.
If you were to look back at when you lived in China the last time and your most recent tour now, what things are the same in the economy?
Well, for one, the internet to the outside world is still very restrictive. And if you have a major illness, you could still go bankrupt in China, even though there is a public health system and they have been strengthening it. The other thing is the unpredictability, I would say, of government rules and regulations. And this is one of the things that the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China also touch on, is that a lot of times it's not just foreign businesses, it's just any private businesses, they don't know when suddenly the officials change the rules. And sometimes they're not official either. They're unwritten. And who gets this information first? And how do they go about getting it? That's the major frustration for a lot of businesses here, not just foreign ones.
So looking ahead, what big trends are you predicting are going to shape the Chinese economy in 2020 and forward?
Well, I would never get into the business of prediction. And anyone who tells you that they know what's going on in China, absolutely, is you should run away from them, I would say. But what I will point out is that in 2008, after the financial crisis, China had implemented a huge economic stimulus of like $580 billion. At that time, I remember you had people... I think it just rained or something. So at a tree trunk, there had been a water that had collected at the bottom of this tree. And there were no less than six workers, I kid you not, shoveling the water out because wages were really, really cheap. But now in 2019, with China's economy slowing down naturally, and then with the added pressure of the U.S.-China tariff war, wages have continued to go up. We're hearing from factories, manufacturers reporting 10 to 20% wage increases per year.
Wow.
So how the government is going to deal with this is going to be a focal point. Another thing would be in the year 2020, China plans to eradicate absolute poverty. So how is China going to do that? That's something I'm definitely interested to explore further in the new year.
Ambitious goals indeed. Marketplace China correspondent Jennifer Pak in Shanghai. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Coming up, the humour of having Playtex involved didn't sit very well.
some 1960s drama between a women's underwear company and NASA. But first, let's do the numbers. With Wall Street markets closed today for the Christmas holiday, we'll check in on some other numbers. The National Retail Federation says stores expect about 11% of holiday sales will be returned. That's from a survey last year, and the number tends to stay pretty consistent. And maybe that's because that noisy kid toy, while a thoughtful gesture from some relative, is going to drive you crazy and probably needs to be spirited away like a ghost of Christmas past. And for your winter getaway, if you're heading to the slopes, the National Ski Areas Association says there were 476 places to ski this year, and more than 59 million people got in some snow sport action, up from 53 million the season before. Stay safe out there this winter. You're listening to Marketplace.
Here at Marketplace, our mission goes beyond reporting the news. It's to make people smarter about the economy through reliable, independent journalism. Your support is what makes it all possible. Whether you donate a little or a lot, being a Marketplace investor makes you a partner in that mission. If you're already giving, thank you so much for going above and beyond. If not, well, look, there's still time. Donate today at Marketplace.org, and thanks for believing in what we do.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. For many years, the country of Zimbabwe was defined by two things: the struggle for independence and Robert Mugabe, who led the country from 1980 until he was forced out in 2017. Mugabe is now gone, but the country is struggling to emerge from his shadow. For many Zimbabweans, life has not improved since then. Long lines for gas and food and electricity shortages are common. Earlier this year, human rights groups said 12 people were killed in widespread protests after the government increased the price of fuel. The BBC's Stephen Sacker reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Mbari, a sprawling slum on the outskirts of Harare. It's where Zimbabweans come to escape crushing rural poverty. A crowd gathers around a stall selling basic provisions. When I ask them whether life has improved under the successor to Robert Mugabe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, their answer is unanimous.
No!
The chronically sick are being sent home from one of Harare's biggest hospitals. Almost all the doctors are refusing to work. They don't call it a strike. They say they've been incapacitated by salaries that have been dramatically devalued. Tapiwa Mungofa had initially been proud to qualify as a medic, but not now.
People are dying avoidable deaths because of the current situation, and the healthcare system in Zimbabwe has collapsed. There is no healthcare system to talk about.
But the government would say that is on your conscience.
Yes, but it's not on our conscience because we cannot afford to come to work, and I cannot use my conscience to pay for my bills. I cannot use my conscience to pay for transport. I am just an ordinary employee like any other employee, and I need to be capacitated for me to do my job.
The Zimbabwean government fears as many as 7.5 million people will need emergency food aid next year. Officials deny that this is the result of mismanagement or misrule. The environment minister, Mangaliso Ndlovu, blames continued sanctions and the impact of Zimbabwe's prolonged drought.
When we talk of people going hungry, we are literally talking about food on the table. And food on the table, there is a direct impact coming from the drought that we have experienced. And this has stretched, if I may say, government social protection expenditure, because we have had to import close to 70% of our grain just to make sure that there is adequate grain in the country.
At sunset in Mbari, the mood shifts quickly. The entire neighborhood is plunged into darkness. The electricity grid has been crippled by a lack of hydroelectric power. So the only light comes from oil lamps, fires, and the lucky few with generators. Down a maze of dark alleys, in a block originally built for single male laborers, but now teeming with families, I meet Yvonne Mugombe. She and three generations of her family live in one room, and after dark, they huddle together by candlelight.
Sometimes we just sit and talk. We don't have food to eat. Sometimes we just sleep without eating.
What do you think the future is going to be for your family?
The future is not good at all, because there is no one going to school. There is no one who's got a job. We just sit, we just wait for people to help us to find food to eat. We ask for people to help us.
Outside a Harare bank, hundreds wait in a long queue. Under Mugabe, hyperinflation meant the US dollar became the de facto currency. Now there's an effort to reintroduce the Zimbabwean dollar, but only in limited amounts, and people tell me that they can withdraw barely enough to last a single day. From Mbari, Zimbabwe, I'm the BBC's Stephen Sacker for Marketplace.
Now, a little history. In July of 1969, 528 million people tuned in to watch the moon landing. What they probably weren't thinking of during this historic moment was the work that went into building the spacesuits that allowed Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong to, you know, survive on the lunar surface. Temperatures on the moon can swing from a boiling nearly 400 degrees to a frigid negative 320 degrees Fahrenheit. Cassia St. Clair wrote about the technological feat behind those spacesuits and the tension, too, in her book, The Golden Thread, How Fabric Changed History.
If you're thinking about the majesty of getting human beings into space, the company that allowed this to happen, that created the spacesuits, may surprise you. They're known as Playtex and famous for making women's underwear. There was a huge mismatch or culture clash between Playtex and NASA. At NASA, they very much didn't like the idea that there were traditional pattern-cutting techniques and seamstresses involved in the making of these spacesuits. They wanted their astronauts and they wanted the spacesuits to be the pinnacle of technological achievement. And there was something about the folksiness and in fact, you know, the humour of having Playtex involved that didn't sit very well. Some of the materials that were being commonly used in other Playtex items later came to be used in the Apollo 11 spacesuits. So, for example, during testing, when some of the astronauts were complaining that areas of the suits were chafing, Playtex, you know, had a solution. They found that they had some fluffy girdle liner that, you know, women used to stop their girdles chafing. And this was just put into the spacesuits. There was this sort of incredible tension throughout the 60s. You know, once Playtex had won the contract, there were several attempts to undercut them. And other companies were sort of invited produce alternative suits that might be better than the Playtex ones. But the Playtex suits kept on coming up trumps. And in fact, it was their 21-layer A7L Omega suit that allowed humankind to walk on space for the first time in 1969.
We've got a series called I've Always Wondered, where you ask a question and we go and find an answer. Send us what you've been wondering. Our website is marketplace.org. This final note on the way out. This year, the BBC and FX premiered a new adaptation of the holiday classic A Christmas Carol. 4.7 million people tuned in to watch the premiere, more evidence that the relatively short story by Charles Dickens is a reliable moneymaker around the holidays. There have been hundreds of versions for the stage and radio and TV and the movie theater over the years. The highest grossing adaptation was the 2009 version starring Jim Carrey, which made more than $325 million at the box office worldwide. My family's favorite is the 1970 musical version, Scrooge, starring Albert Finney. Love the music. We've got to go. The markets were closed today for the Christmas holiday, but they'll resume regular hours tomorrow. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. And I'm Kimberly Adams. If you celebrate the holiday, I hope it was a good one. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.